And so the next sutta is in the Salayatana Sanyutta, Sanyutta 35, sutta number 70, concerning the Sandhittika Dhamma, directly visible. Then the Venerable Upavanna approached the Blessed One and said to him, "Venerable Sir, it is said, the directly visible Dhamma, the directly visible Dhamma. In what way, Venerable Sir, is the Dhamma directly visible, immediate, inviting one to come and see, applicable, to be personally experienced by the wise?" Which, of course, is a standard reflection on the Dhamma. We do that in the chanting. Translated slightly different, but that's the same Pali. Here, Upavanna, having seen a form with the eye, a bhikkhu experiences the form as well as lust for the form. He understands that lust for forms exists internally thus. There is in me lust for forms internally. Since that is so, Upavanna, the Dhamma is directly visible, immediate, inviting one to come and see, applicable, to be personally experienced by the wise. Further, Upavanna, having heard a sound with the ear, smelt an odor with the nose, tasted a flavor with the tongue, experienced the tangible with the body, having cognized a mental phenomenon with the mind, a bhikkhu experiences the mental phenomenon as well as lust for the mental phenomenon. He understands that lust for mental phenomenon exists internally thus. There is in me lust for mental phenomenon internally. Since that is so, Upavanna, the Dhamma is directly visible, immediate, inviting one to come and see, applicable, to be personally experienced by the wise. But here, Upavanna, having seen a form with the eye, a bhikkhu experiences the form without experiencing lust for the form. He understands that lust for forms does not exist internally thus. There is in me no lust for forms internally. Since that is so, Upavanna, the Dhamma is directly visible, immediate, inviting one to come and see, applicable, to be experienced by the wise. Further, Upavanna, having heard a sound with the ear and so on, having cognized a mental phenomenon with the mind, a bhikkhu experiences the mental phenomenon without experiencing lust for mental phenomenon. He understands that lust for mental phenomena does not exist internally thus. There is in me no lust for mental phenomena internally. Since that is so, Upavanna, the Dhamma is directly visible, immediate, inviting one to come and see, applicable, to be experienced by the wise. So that, just that, not making it complicated, esoteric, distant, recognizing what is there as being there, what is not there as not there, in terms of the senses and the response to that sense contact. Keeping it simple.
That's interesting because it just seems like the Dhamma is directly visible, whether defilements are present or not, or hindrance is present or not. It's just the truth of the way it is.
Yes, the truth of the way it is. Yeah. This is the way, this is what it feels like when you experience lust and desire and aversion and delusion and within nature, in the response to the senses. And this is what it's like when one doesn't. And both are to be understood.
Because there does seem to be a view that the Dhamma is only visible when those things disappear.
Right. Yeah. Because that's the Buddha saying, what the Buddha teaches is dukkha and the cessation of dukkha. So the understanding what dukkha is and how to bring it to cessation. Right. Okay. It's, next sutta, Sangyutta 35, sutta number 74. It's a nice sutta showing the compassion of the Buddha. Atsavati. Then a certain bhikkhu approached the Blessed One, paid homage to him, sat down to one side, and said to him, "Venerable Sir, in such and such a dwelling, there is a certain newly ordained bhikkhu, not well known, who is sick, afflicted, gravely ill. It would be good, Venerable Sir, if the Blessed One would approach that bhikkhu out of compassion." Then when the Blessed One heard the words, "newly ordained" and "sick," and understood that he was not a well-known bhikkhu, he went to him. That bhikkhu saw the Blessed One coming in the distance and stirred on his bed. He was wanting to get down and pay respects and not be in a higher place. The Blessed One said to him, "Enough, bhikkhu, do not stir on your bed. There are these seats ready, I will sit down there." The Blessed One then sat down on the appointed seat and said to that bhikkhu, "I hope you are bearing up, bhikkhu. I hope you are getting better. I hope that your painful feelings are subsiding and not increasing, and that their subsiding, not their increase, is to be discerned." "Venerable Sir, I am not bearing up. I am not getting better. Strong, painful feelings are increasing in me, not subsiding, and their increase, not their subsiding, is to be discerned. I hope then, bhikkhu, that you are not troubled by remorse and regret." "Indeed, Venerable Sir, I have quite a lot of remorse and regret." "I hope, bhikkhu, that you have nothing for which to reproach yourself in regard to virtue." "I have nothing, Venerable Sir, for which to reproach myself in regard to virtue." "Then, bhikkhu, if you have nothing for which to reproach yourself in regard to virtue, why are you troubled by remorse and regret?" "I understand, Venerable Sir, that it is not for the sake of purification of virtue that the Dhamma has been taught by the Blessed One." "If, bhikkhu, you understand that the Dhamma has not been taught by me for the sake of purification of virtue, then for what purpose do you understand the Dhamma to have been taught by me?" "Venerable Sir, I understand the Dhamma to have been taught by the Blessed One for the sake of the fading away of lust." "Good, good, bhikkhu. It is good that you understand the Dhamma to have been taught by me for the sake of the fading away of lust. For the Dhamma is taught by me for the sake of the fading away of lust. What do you think, bhikkhu? Is the eye permanent or impermanent?" "Impermanent, Venerable Sir." "Is the ear permanent or impermanent?" "Impermanent, Venerable Sir." "Is what is impermanent suffering or happiness?" "Suffering, Venerable Sir." Of course, he goes through all the sense bases. "Is what is impermanent suffering and subject to change fit to be regarded thus? This is mine, this I am, this is myself." "No, Venerable Sir." Seeing thus, he understands, blah, 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 through the standard thing, there is no more for this state of being. This is what the Blessed One said. Elated, that bhikkhu delighted in the Blessed One's statement. And while this discourse was being spoken, there arose in that bhikkhu the dust-free, stainless vision of the Dhamma. Whatever is subject to origination is all subject to cessation. So he became a stream enterer. And it's just taking that the same from the Anatta Lakkhana Sutta, and then applying that to the senses and the all the different senses: eye, ear, nose, tongue, body, mind. Yeah.
Seems that was sometimes an advantage to get sick and
not. Yes, you have the Buddha coming to your bedside. That's great. Of course, there must be better ways. just that sense of the Buddha. Savati was, there was a large monastery, and there was what do you call it, infirmary for the sick bhikkhus, and the Buddha would from time, and there's many discourses where the Buddha would go and visit the and see how the sick bhikkhus were doing. And see all those bhikkhus sitting around on their benches. Yes.
You mentioned about the lust and the fading away of lust.
Mm-hmm.
And the first sutta is lust in the absence of lust. It's sort of implicit that with aversion, in regards to aversion, like the opposite of lust. Kind of,
yes, yes. Yeah, that's a sort of like a implicit in that isn't the other defilements. It's like with greed, hatred, and delusion, or what are called the kilesa mula, the root of defilements, and then lust is an expression of that, and then implicit in that would be the others. Okay, the next sutta is a favorite sutta of Lumbo Charles, and hear him repeat this from time to time. It's sutta number 88, Samyutta 35, 88. Then the Venerable Putna approached the Blessed One and said to him, said that Putna had been a merchant from the Suna Paramita country who came to Savati on business. Hearing the Buddha preach, he decided to become a bhikkhu. After his ordination, he found the area around Savati uncongenial to his meditation and wished to return to his home country to continue his practice. And he approached the Buddha to obtain guidance before departure. So Suna Paramita was on the west coast of India. Its capital was Suparaka, modern Soparla, in the district of Thane, near modern Mumbai. Which is kind of interesting just how far flung that the people from the in India started in these early days hearing the reputation of the Buddha already and coming to take ordination. Okay, then the Venerable Putna addressed the Blessed One and said to him, "Venerable Sir, it would be good if the Blessed One would teach me the Dhamma in brief, so that, having heard the Dhamma from the Blessed One, I might dwell alone, withdrawn, diligent, ardent, and resolute." Puna, there are forms cognizable by the eye that are desirable, lovely, agreeable, pleasing, sensually enticing, tantalizing. If a bhikkhu delights in them, welcomes them, and remains holding to them, delight arises in him. With the arising of delight, Puna, there is the arising of suffering, I say. There are, Puna, sounds cognizable by the ear, odors cognizable by the nose, flavors cognizable by the tongue, tangibles cognizable by the body, mental phenomena cognizable by the mind, that are desirable, lovely, agreeable, pleasing, sensually enticing, tantalizing. If a bhikkhu seeks delight in them, welcomes them, and remains holding to them, delight arises in him. With the arising of delight, Puna, there is the arising of suffering, I say. Puna, there are forms cognizable by the eye, and so on, mental phenomena cognizable by the mind, that are desirable, lovely, agreeable, pleasing, sensually enticing, tantalizing. If a bhikkhu does not seek delight in them, does not welcome them, and does not remain holding to them, delight ceases in him. With the cessation of delight, Puna, there is the cessation of suffering, I say. Now that you have received this brief exhortation from me, Puna, in which country will you dwell? There is, Venerable Sir, a country named Suna Paramita. I will dwell there. Puna, the people of Suna Paramita are wild and rough. If they abuse and revile you, what will you think about that? Venerable Sir, if the people of Sunnaparanta abuse and revile me, then I will think, these people of Sunnaparanta are excellent, truly excellent, in that they do not give me a blow with the fist. Then I will think thus, blessed one, then I will think thus, fortunate one. But Puna, if the people of Sunnaparanta do give you a blow with the fist, what will you think about that? Venerable Sir, if the people of Sunnaparanta give me a blow with the fist, then I will think, these people of Sunnaparanta are excellent, truly excellent, in that they do not give me a blow with a clod. Then I will think thus, blessed one, then I will think thus, fortunate one. But Puna, if the people of Sunnaparanta do give you a blow with a clod, what will you think about that? Venerable Sir, if the people of Sunnaparanta give me a blow with a clod, then I will think, these people of Sunnaparanta are excellent, truly excellent, in that they do not give me a blow with a rod. Then I will think thus, blessed one, then I will think thus, fortunate one. But Puna, if the people of Sunnaparanta do give you a blow with a rod, what will you think about that? Venerable Sir, if the people of Sunnaparanta give me a blow with a rod, then I will think, these people of Sunnaparanta are excellent, truly excellent, in that they do not stab me with a knife. Then I will think thus, blessed one, then I will think thus, fortunate one. But, Puna, if the people of Sunnaparanta do stab you with a knife, what will you think about that? Venerable Sir, if the people of Sunnaparanta stab me with a knife, then I will think, these people of Sunnaparanta are excellent, truly excellent, in that they do not take my life with a sharp knife. Then I will think thus, blessed one, then I will think thus, fortunate one. But Puna, if the people of Sunnaparanta do take your life with a sharp knife, what will you think about that? Venerable Sir, if the people of Sunnaparanta take my life with a sharp knife, then I will think, there have been disciples of the Blessed One who, being repelled, humiliated, and disgusted by the body and by life, sought for an assailant. That is, somebody to take their life. But I have come, and that's his story. Of course, that's a story in the first Parajika? Third Parajika. But I have come upon this assailant, even without a search. Then I will think thus, blessed one. Then I will think thus, fortunate one. Good, good, Puna. Endowed with such self-control and peacefulness, you will be able to dwell in the Sunnaparanta country. Now, Puna, you may go at your own convenience. Then, having delighted and rejoiced in the Blessed One's statement, the Venerable Puna rose from his seat, paid homage to the Blessed One, and departed, keeping him on his right. He then set his lodging in order, took his bowl and outer robe, and set out to wander towards the Sunnaparanta country. Wandering by stages, he eventually arrived in the Sunnaparanta country, where he dwelt. Then, during that reign, the Venerable Puna established 500 male lay followers and 500 female lay followers in the practice. And he himself, during that same reign, realized the three true knowledges, and during that same reign, he attained final Nibbana. Then a number of bhikkhus approached the Blessed One and said to him, Venerable Sir, the clansman named Puna, who was given a brief exhortation by the Blessed One, has died. What is his destination? What is his future born? Because the clansman Puna was wise, he practiced in accordance with the Dhamma and did not trouble me on account of the Dhamma. The clansman Puna has attained final Nibbana. So, a nice story.
Yes. I'm guessing there was maybe a period of time after that reigns before he died. It's not like it had to happen right away.
Well, hard to say. Yeah. It says during that same reigns.
Oh, during the same reigns.
During the same reigns he passed away. Mm-hmm. Yes, fruitful reigns. Think of the establishing 500 male lay followers, 500 female lay followers. kind of, you know, I mean, I think of in current time, of it's not quite one reigns, but think of Ajahn Lee Dhammadharma coming to from the northeast, bringing the kind of the forest practice and to well, Canterbury first. He was just there for a little bit, and then to Sumut Prakan, close to Bangkok, outskirts of Bangkok, and setting up Wat Asoka Ram, and then huge numbers of people in a short period of time becoming established in the Dhamma and practicing and monks ordaining and really establishing the kind of meditation practice in an area which is not traditionally oriented to practice at all, and then he passed away. Very, you know, he wasn't that old.
How did he die?
Probably a heart attack. Probably a heart attack.
He already had a heart attack.
Hmm?
He already had a heart attack.
Yeah.
Before.
Yeah.
And that's how he discovered his breath meditation method too.
Uh huh.
He brought himself out.
Oh.
He was in the wilderness just for anything.
Huh.
And it was losing his mind. Just focused on his body.
Yeah. I forgot that. Continuing on, some Sutta 35, Sutta number 93, of a comprehensive reflection on impermanence. It's called the Dyad, because consciousness comes to be in dependence on a dyad. And how? Because does consciousness come to be in dependence on a dyad? Independence on the eye and forms, there arises eye consciousness. The eye is impermanent, changing, becoming otherwise. Forms are impermanent, changing, becoming otherwise. Thus this dyad is moving and tottering, impermanent, changing, becoming otherwise. Eye consciousness is impermanent, changing, becoming otherwise. The cause and condition for the arising of eye consciousness is also impermanent, changing, becoming otherwise. When, bhikkhus, eye consciousness has arisen in dependence on a condition that is impermanent, how could it be permanent? The meeting, the encounter, the concurrence of these three things is called eye contact. Eye contact, too, is impermanent, changing, becoming otherwise. The cause and condition for the arising of eye contact is also impermanent, changing, becoming otherwise. When, bhikkhus, eye contact has arisen in dependence on a condition that is impermanent, how could it be permanent? Contacted, bhikkhus, one feels. Contacted, one intends. Contacted, one perceives. Thus these things, too, are moving and tottering, impermanent, changing, becoming otherwise. Independence on the ear and sounds, and of course through all the sense bases that the independence on the mind and mental phenomena, there arises mind consciousness. The mind is impermanent, changing, becoming otherwise. Mental phenomena are impermanent, changing, becoming otherwise. Thus this dyad is moving and tottering, impermanent, changing, becoming otherwise. Mind consciousness is impermanent, changing, becoming otherwise. The cause and condition for the arising of mind consciousness is also impermanent, changing, becoming otherwise. When, bhikkhus, mind consciousness has arisen in dependence on a condition that is impermanent, how could it be permanent? The meeting, the encounter, the concurrence of these three things is called mind contact. Mind contact too is impermanent, changing, becoming otherwise. The cause and condition for the arising of mind contact is also impermanent, changing, becoming otherwise. When, bhikkhus, mind contact has arisen in dependence on a condition that is impermanent, how could it be permanent? Contacted, bhikkhus, one feels. Contacted, one intends. Contacted, one perceives. Thus these things too are moving and tottering, impermanent, changing, becoming otherwise. It is in such a way, bhikkhus, that consciousness comes to be independence on a dyad. So it's just this comprehensive reflection, analysis of the sense bases, the consciousness that arises, the contact that arises. Because of contact, one feels, one intends, one perceives, all of the kind of the edifice of the mind that builds up all of our perceptions, conceptions, feelings, emotions, the whole schmear are all based on all these impermanent phenomena, so that the idea of something permanent, everlasting, eternal arising out of that is kind of nuts. I'd say it's helpful to be taking that, because the feeling is so often, or the way that we perceive or assume things to be in terms of and certainly how we've been conditioned, these aspects of particularly around that sense of a self, a soul, an eternal being somewhere, and think about how could it possibly be?
That's a really wonderful sort of analysis of the intimacy of nama rupa and consciousness.
Yes. All that that all is leaning on each other. Sheaves of grain. Just leaning up against each other, waiting to topple.
When yourself or when one is contemplating these, the aspects, say, of impermanence or the fetter that arises in the conjunction with the sense bases, do you find any benefit one way or the other of, say, focusing on that quality, like impermanence or the fetter, as it arises in any sense space that happens to come into focus, or better to stay with a particular sense space at a time with that quality of mind and just really hold to that?
It really depends on the quality of mind at that time. If the mind is really peaceful and steady and can sustain that attention really closely, then just sticking with one sense base, it tends to be more fruitful. If it's a bit more, the mind is not so steady and firm, and then it, by following the different sense bases, it's more of a discursive investigation, which of course brings up a sense of urgency or faith or different qualities, which then helps the mind to settle. But they have it's because of the actual state of the mind at that time. That's how my own experience.
there, is that specifically referring to sankara?
Would be, well, it would be, the intention would be, jetana, jeteti, probably would be the verb, intending. Then the, that's more of a, you know, the, it would end up into being a sankhara. That's the nature of how do you say, the characteristic of the sankharas, but it's more, a bit more, one step back of primal movement of mind towards an object.
This might be leading to Abhidhamma, just a little bit of time, but first, I have a question about this arising and ceasing of consciousness, and that sometimes in meditation it's possible to see that something like the gravity of some really small sense door, how there's like this experience of seeing consciousness arise on account of the contact. In other words, it's at one moment it's not there, and then there's contact, and then it's there.
Yeah.
Contact phase and interface.
Yeah.
So there's a, you know, when the mind is really concentrated, you can see that. That's one thing. But there's this sort of theory that the mind is going out and seeing it rather than consciousness is just arising, and that is mind at that moment. And then, you know, that's what mind knows at that moment. And then consciousness goes away, and then there's mind consciousness still. So the idea that, that mind consciousness also arises and disappears, that's not so visible. Is there a way to sort of see that?
Well, I think one of the things is by just by recognizing the, I mean, that's where the, how do you say it, that image of the kind of the magician or the, you know, that conjurer's trick would be able to hold that continuity, because it is, you know, part of the you know, the function of somebody who is skilled at illusion is able to take your mind away from things so that you can. So similar with that mind consciousness is able to kind of keep that continuity going, but it's really skipping from object to object, and it's sort of selectively looking at things arising and ceasing. So that I think one of the things is just by you know, by watching the actual thoughts arising, feelings arising, just the fact that they are arising and ceasing, and that the mind is actually moving. It's not a continuum. It isn't a continuum of solid experience. It's a feeling of, say, knowledge that is moving to different places. And so that it's more of a, you know, there's one starts to pay attention to those, how the mind goes to different objects, and then that so, oh, okay, well, in that case, it's, yeah, it really does have to be impermanent. It's more of a
it's more deduction
than I mean, I suppose there's people who can see that, but I'm, you know, my own sense is that the more one looks into it, the more one watches that. I mean, you're getting the more the mind is kind of clear, but it's still, you're seeing arising and ceasing, and so that. But it isn't as if you're just honing right into the, able to see the mind door, and that is, I think, it's more of a deduction, a recognition of all that. It has to be like that. Yeah.
Is it the longer the state? Is that like, you know, you're not aware of anything?
Let's see.
Well, like that kind of state, I'm thinking, like, could you see the mind and the consciousness arising? Like, if you're in a state where you're just, you know, completely deluded, not noticing anything, then when you come to be aware, then you would notice, oh, there was a mind consciousness wasn't even engaged.
Yeah, I think that's true in the sense of when, you know, the mind has slipped into something kind of less than lucid, not so much through that present moment, but because of the intention, then your mind consciousness sort of becomes more clear again. Yeah, that's true. Okay, let's sit quietly for a couple minutes.